expected asset return is equal to the risk-free rate plus beta times the difference between the expected market return and the risk-free rate. Let's take a deeper look at each of the terms within CAPM to understand why it is considered such a powerful tool that has allowed investment managers to think about the trade-offs between risk and return more robustly, and therefore design and create more efficient portfolios. Essentially, what CAPM says is that any asset should be expected to earn, at a minimum, the risk-free rate, the rate which we can earn without taking any risk of principal loss, and then some premium for assuming additional risk. This additional risk is really comprised of two things. One, the asset's beta, and two, what we call the equity risk premium, which is the amount that the overall market is expected to earn above the risk-free rate. That is, if you put a certain amount of money into a diversified portfolio of stocks, say in 30 different companies in different industries, we know that this portfolio, while diversified, is still more risky than owning a risk-free U.S. Treasury bond. And we should expect to be compensated for taking on that additional risk. Again, it may or may not happen, since there is still some material market risk in such a portfolio, but we should expect to earn some premium. This is known as the equity risk premium. Academics have argued extensively to how much this equity risk premium is. But today, most academics and market experts agree that it is between 5 and 6%. That is, if you invest in a portfolio of diversified stocks, you should expect to earn the risk-free rate, whatever that rate happens to be at the time, plus 5 or 6%. Let's work through an example. Assume you are considering adding a stock to your already diversified portfolio, and further assume that according to Yahoo Finance, the stock has a beta of 2. If we assume that the interest rate on 10-year U.S. Treasury bonds is about 2.5%, and the equity risk premium is 5%, what would be the expected return from this particular stock? The answer is 12.5%. We take the 2.5% risk-free rate and add that to 2 times the equity risk premium of 5%. 2.5% plus 10% gives us the expected return of 12.5%. If the equity risk premium were higher than 5%, say 6%, our expected return would then be higher, 14.5% equal to 2.5% plus 2 times 6%. We can actually take CAPM and this relatively simple math and create something known as the security market line. It is essentially a visual depiction of an individual asset's expected return using CAPM. Now that we have introduced CAPM as a predictive model of an individual asset or portfolio's expected return, we can use the model to evaluate the performance of active fund managers, those who pick stocks for a living in order to beat the market. Stepping back, there are two broad types of investing, active and passive. Passive investing means that we are going to invest in the overall market as opposed to trying to pick winners or losers. Many of us likely own certain index funds or exchange-traded funds, which simply invest in every stock in the entire stock market, whether that market is the S&P 500, the Russell 2000, or some other broad stock market index. That is, passive investors are not trying to beat the market, but are just trying to match it. On the other hand, many of us have our money with active fund managers, those people we think are really good at picking stocks, separating the winners from the dogs. Well, how can we separate wheat from chaff, knowing which active fund managers are really good as opposed to just lucky, or from those who may have beaten the market but exposed us to greater risk in the process? Well, it isn't enough to look at a particular portfolio manager's return in a given year, compare it to the overall market and conclude, voila, that this manager truly added value. After all, maybe they invested in a portfolio of stocks all with betas of 2? If so, what would we expect from them? Well, with CAPM, we can examine a fund manager's portfolio, determine the risk that he or she took as measured by beta, and use that beta to predict how the manager should have done relative to the market. With that information, we can look at how they actually did perform, and then perhaps we can make some conclusions about the manager's actual ability. If the manager did better than CAPM would have predicted, then this could indicate that the manager actually did create value, something known as alpha. But if the manager underperformed what CAPM would have predicted, given the risk that manager assumed in their portfolio, we might rightfully question their stock picking abilities. We would say that that particular manager generated negative alpha. For example, let's say that a particular fund manager's portfolio had a weighted average beta of 1.2 during a particular year. What would we expect from that portfolio during the year? Well, we would expect that the fund would move by 20% more than the overall market in either direction as a result of the 1.2 beta. That is, if the overall stock market went up by 10% during the year, we would expect this fund to have gone up by 12%. So what if the fund manager's portfolio went up by 15%? We would conclude that this manager added additional value from the particular selection of stocks, an additional 3% of positive alpha. Now, given this portfolio manager's one-year results generating positive alpha of 3%, we might not automatically conclude that this manager is indeed a great stock picker. Maybe he or she just got lucky. But what about fund managers who are able to generate positive alpha over long periods of time, like Warren Buffett? Maybe he is just a statistical anomaly or a really, really lucky individual, but quite possibly he is just a very talented investor. In any event, in recent years, a lot of research has gone into the predictive ability of CAPM. After all, while its theoretical underpinnings make a lot of sense, when actually realized returns are compared to what CAPM would have predicted, we find that the model is able to account for about 85 to 90% of the price movements that historical betas would have anticipated. That is not too shabby, but academics in finance and economics have spent considerable time and energy trying to refine CAPM and improve its predictive abilities by adding variables and testing whether they add to the model's predictive power. Perhaps the most well-known of these models is the Fama and French three-factor model. In addition to the beta factor, the renowned researchers Eugene Fama and Ken French found two more factors that improved CAPM's predictive abilities: a stock's value and the size of the company. Now, in Fama and French's model, a stock's value is determined by taking a company's shareholders' equity from the balance sheet and then comparing that to the market's capitalization for the stock, essentially the company's value in the stock market. For example, if a stock has a book value or shareholders' equity of $1 billion as reflected in the balance sheet and a market capitalization of $500 million, it would appear to be a good value since you are paying a discount for the company's reported net assets. Fama and French determined that there was a positive relationship between expected returns and this value factor. This seems intuitive. If you are buying a stock at what appears to be a discounted price, you should in turn expect a higher return. And the opposite is true. If the stock market is valuing a company at multiples of what it is reporting as assets on its balance sheet, it appears that you are buying it at a premium, and therefore your expected return looking forward should be lower. They also found that smaller companies, as measured by stock market capitalization, performed better than CAPM would have predicted. Why might that be? Well, one theory is that these smaller stocks are not widely followed by Wall Street analysts or larger institutions, so they may be undiscovered. In fact, some mutual funds cannot even purchase stocks unless they are large enough and have enough liquidity in the marketplace. In essence, these smaller stocks fly under the radar and should have higher expected returns, at least according to Fama and French. That is what their predictive model suggests. In conclusion, any asset's expected return is based on historical return, which provides some basis for predicting likely future results, at least over extended periods of time. But we understand that while we may expect certain outcomes, results may vary, certainly over shorter investment periods. In addition, we know that while we may expect to earn higher returns with the more risk that we take, investors cannot and should not expect to be compensated with additional return for that portion of risk that is stock-specific and can easily be diversified away by adding additional stocks to a portfolio. And finally, the capital asset pricing model and the subsequent research it has compelled provide an intuitive and powerful means of formally unifying an asset's expected return and risk, defining risk primarily in terms of how an asset fluctuates in comparison to the overall markets. Well, that concludes our lecture on the inevitable trade-off between risk and return. Until next time, when we will delve into net present value, an extremely practical and useful valuation tool. Thank you very much.
This lecture is titled, How Investors Use Net Present Value.
In 2000, America Online, known to most of us as AOL, announced the largest corporate acquisition in history, merging with Time Warner, the media conglomerate, in a transaction valued at $164 billion. The deal was finalized in 2001. As it turned out, it proved to be the worst acquisition in history, as it became clear in time that AOL wildly overpaid for the acquisition, and the merged company ended up writing off over $100 billion of the purchase price. On the other hand, other acquisitions have fared very, very well, such as Disney's $7.4 billion acquisition of Pixar, the producer and creator of animated films like Toy Story, Cars, and Monsters, Inc. It would be hard to argue that $7.4 billion was a steal, but it appears that Disney ended up getting a good deal and making a smart and value-creating acquisition for its shareholders. Why was one acquisition so successful and the other an unmitigated disaster? While some might point to difficulties in integrating the companies or a failure to achieve certain projected growth, economies of scale, or cost cuts, the answer essentially comes down to a simple proposition. In one case, the acquirer simply paid too high a price for what it was getting, and in the other, the acquirer negotiated and paid a fair, perhaps not a bargain, but a fair price for what they bought. When companies are considering potential investment opportunities, whether the acquisition of another company or even the acquisition of a piece of equipment or real estate, how should they evaluate and analyze these potential investments? Clearly, the objective of any investment should be to create value. But what does value mean? In simplest terms, value is created when the future benefits arising from an investment exceed the amount invested, its cost. So, for example, the only way that the acquisition of Time Warner would have made any sense and created value for AOL shareholders would be for Time Warner to produce more than $164 billion in incremental cash flows to AOL over time. Basically, we need to earn more from an investment over time than we pay for it. However, as we discussed in an earlier lecture, and we'll discuss again today, we know that future cash flows are worth less than today's cash flows. And there's the rub. We generally know what an investment is going to cost us, since we usually pay for it up front. $164 billion, $7.4 billion, or $350. But the returns or cash flows from the investment come back to us at some future point in time. And those future cash flows are worth less because of the time value of money, which we discussed in an earlier lecture. So because that $164 billion purchase price was paid up front by AOL, they must have been projecting some remarkable future cash flows to make it pencil. Obviously, things didn't nearly work out as planned. In this lecture, we are going to discuss several different approaches used for evaluating investment opportunities: the payback method, the accounting or book rate of return, and finally, net present value, or NPV for short. Along with the capital asset pricing model, which we introduced in our last lecture, net present value may be the most important mathematical formula in finance. It combines several of the concepts we have discussed thus far in this course: the time value of money, expected rates of return, and risk. NPV combines them into a powerful investment decision-making tool with very widespread applications. For example, imagine you are a chief financial officer for a particular company, and for the coming year, you have a budget of X million dollars that you can spend on capital projects. Such projects might include the opening of a new manufacturing plant, the acquisition of some new machinery or equipment, or the start of some research and development on a new potential product. How should the CFO decide between the alternative investment opportunities, assuming they cannot all be pursued? How should they rank them? NPV will help us answer these questions. Or how about this scenario? Imagine you are Bill and Melinda Gates, among the wealthiest people on the planet, who have pledged to donate virtually all of their extraordinary wealth to charitable causes. You may know that Bill Gates was the co-founder and longtime chief executive of Microsoft. Some of the Gates causes include education and disease prevention, including minimizing the future incidence of HIV infections in Africa. Can the concepts we will discuss in this lecture, including net present value, assist them in best allocating their resources to fulfill their philanthropic objectives? As we will discuss, the answer is yes, and another reason why the net present value tool is so useful. To put this tool in perspective, let's first step back and think about the basic structure of any investment opportunity, whether it be a firm making a capital budgeting decision, a charitable organization deciding how best to spend its limited resources, or an individual investor deciding whether to purchase a particular stock. They are all essentially structured the same way. An upfront investment is made today in the anticipation of some uncertain cash flows or returns in the future. During the years the investment is owned, it may generate some cash flows to us, maybe dividends, interest, or rents. And then at some point in the future, the investment is sold or disposed of at some unknown price. To make smart and value-creating investment decisions, the future returns or cash flows, which are worth less than the dollars expended today when the time value of money is considered, must exceed the amount invested. That is, the present value of the projected future inflows must be greater than the present value of the outflows. This is essentially the definition of NPV. However, before we delve further into NPV, let's start with a very common approach to investment decision-making, something known as the payback method. The payback method essentially answers the following question. If I make an investment of X dollars today, how long do I have to wait until I recoup my investment? For example, if I invest $10,000 and I expect the investment to earn $1,000 each year after taxes, the payback period would be 10 years. A $100,000 investment, which returns $20,000 a year, would have a 5-year payback. All else equal, the shorter the payback period, the better the investment opportunity, of course. Some firms establish maximum allowable payback periods against which investments should be compared. For example, a firm might say that for a new product introduction, the maximum acceptable payback period might be 6 years, or 4 years for certain investments designed to generate improvements in efficiency or reduce future costs. The payback approach is widely used for several reasons. It is fairly simple, easy to apply, and relatively intuitive. We all may have some sense that if we invest in something, a payback within a few years would generally make sense and may ultimately prove to be a good investment. On the other hand, there are some serious deficiencies in the payback approach. After all, the goal of any investment is not just to get your money back to generate a return of your investment, but to actually make a profit to generate a return on your investment. The payback method, while popular, ignores cash flows after the payback period and ignores the time value of money. Moreover, the maximum acceptable payback period is usually arbitrary, reflecting some policy decision established in the past. Therefore, the payback approach just doesn't cut it as an effective way to assess investment opportunities. Another method that has had some traction in the real world is known as the accounting or book rate of return. As we've discussed, when companies report to shareholders and Wall Street, much of the focus is on the income statement, especially revenues, net income, and earnings per share. Cash flows, while certainly important, are usually not given as much emphasis in quarterly and annual earnings releases. As a result, some financial managers might use book accounting data to assess and evaluate investment opportunities instead of cash flows, contrary to what finance theory tells us they should be doing. For example, imagine a company operating at capacity that was considering a $10 million investment in new and more efficient machinery, which would increase productivity and create value for the company and its shareholders. The current machinery, while definitely outdated, is still functional and in use. Further assume that this old machinery, and this is important, has been fully depreciated and therefore has no value on the company's balance sheet. If the CFO were strictly looking at an accounting ROI, any return that the old machines produce would appear to be infinite. That is, the income generated by the machines would be made on something with no accounting value, the depreciated machines. Any positive income divided by zero is going to look great. However, this is a flawed approach because it is based on financial accounting metrics, which includes non-cash depreciation expense, which has caused a significant difference between the accounting value of the equipment under generally accepted accounting principles and its true economic value, which should be based on actual cash flows and true market values. Therefore, it is imperative that we look at cash flows and not financial accounting metrics to determine whether an investment might be value creating. So we need a more robust and more reliable and a more effective means to evaluate investment opportunities than the payback or accounting rate of return approaches. And net present value fits to a T. The net present value is the sum of all the individual outflows and or inflows related to any investment, with each of the individual cash flows discounted to its present value. Hopefully you will recall the basic time value of money formula we introduced in one of our early lectures, but a quick review is in order. Recall that in order to put future cash flows into today's dollars, we must discount them, which requires three different inputs. One, the amount of the cash flows, both the initial acquisition and those earned over time. Two, the relevant interest or discount rate. And three, the time period over which the discounting is to take place. In that earlier lecture, we introduced five different present value formula. For now, let's just reintroduce the basic present value formula for an individual lump sum, which is the cash flow divided by 1 plus the discount rate to the T power. That is, the present value, the amount of some cash flow in the future, is the actual amount of that particular cash flow discounted by 1 plus the relevant interest rate, I, the discount factor, all compounded over time period, T. Suppose, for example, that you expect to receive $100 2 years from today at a discount rate of 5%. What's the present value of that $100? Well, if we plug these numbers into our basic formula, we get $100 divided by 1.05 squared. And that gives us a present value of $90.70. So now that we have reintroduced the basic present value formula, let's walk through the net present value formula, something that definitely should be in our finance toolboxes. In words, we say that the net present value equals the present value of all future cash flows over time, less the amount of the initial investment. If we look at the formula, it looks quite complicated, but it simply builds off what we have already discussed in our time value of money lecture. We start with the amount of the initial cash we need to invest in the project. That is clearly an outflow and is therefore negative. And since it is made at the inception of the investment, it does not need to be discounted at all. Then we estimate the future cash flows we expect the investment to generate over time, discounting each as we go, based on the discount rate and the time period in which the cash flow is expected to be earned. When we add up all the cash flows, both the initial negative investment and the discounted future cash flows, what do we want to see? A positive figure. We say that an investment with a positive net present value is one we should make, since the present value of the cash inflows discounted over time exceeds the present value of the cash outflows, usually the initial investment. Therefore, it is expected to be value creating. And the opposite is true. We should not make any investment with a negative net present value, as it would be value destroying. Let's walk through an example together. Assume that a small regional medical center is considering three mutually exclusive investments in different types of medical equipment, each of which would require an upfront investment of $1.5 million. Let's further assume that each is of equal importance to the organization's strategy. One might be a new surgical robot, the other an MRI machine, and the other a dialysis machine. Again, three different investments that the hospital could make, but it can only choose one, even if all are value-creating, simply because it has a limited amount of capital to invest. Based on input from key personnel, the chief financial officer of the hospital has created a table that projects year-end cash flows for each of the potential investments. So each of the three opportunities will cost the same amount up front, but each has different projected cash flows over time. And finally, and this is important, each has no expected value after 5 years. This might be true for medical equipment, which presumably has a definite useful life, at which point it would need to be sold, discarded, or recycled in some way. Finally, let's assume that the hospital requires a 10% return on whichever investment it decides to make. Which project is preferable using the payback and net present value methods? Remember, with the payback method, we should choose the project which returns our original investment the most quickly. So in this case, which of these three investments gets the hospital its $1.5 million back the most quickly? Well, according to our projected cash flows for each project, the dialysis machine returns the original $1.5 million investment by the end of the third year, which doesn't sound too shabby. But remember that the payback method is all about return of capital, not return on capital, and it is the latter that we really care about. Computing the net present values of each investment will help us there, so let's walk through how we calculate it for each potential investment. For all three, the initial cash outflow is the same, $1.5 million. Because it is an outflow, it is a negative in our NPV formula. Starting with the first potential investment, the surgical robot, the CFO's table indicates that our anticipated future cash flows are $200,000 in year one, with some steady increases over time to $300,000, $400,000, $500,000, and finally $650,000. But we know that the value of that $650,000 in year five is worth far less than the $650,000 today because, one, it happens 5 years out, of course, and because of that 10% discount rate, the rate we want to earn on the investment. In fact, let's plug that $650,000 into our present value formula. We get $650,000 divided by 1.10 to the fifth power. The result is a present value of $403,599. That's what those year five cash flows are worth in today's dollars. Now we can calculate the present value of the projected cash flows for each year the surgical robot is in use. For example, the present value of the $200,000 of cash flows expected in the first year following the investment is about $182,000. The year two cash flows of $300,000 are worth about $248,000 in today's terms, and so on. Now, let's add up the present values of each of the individual cash flows, including the upfront $1.5 million investment. And what's the result? Well, it turns out that we get a result of negative $24,616. That means the surgical robot investment has a projected negative net present value. And if we really believe our projections and indeed require a 10% rate of return, this is not an investment we should make. What about the second potential investment, the MRI machine? Well, based on the numbers in the CFO's table, the net present value turns out to be positive, quite positive, $432,698. So the MRI machine appears to be value-creating indeed with a very positive NPV. And last, but certainly not least, how about the third potential investment, the dialysis machine, which had the quickest payback, 3 years? Well, when we plug the CFO's numbers into our NPV formula, it too turns out to have a positive NPV, $395,393. So it would definitely be an investment worth pursuing if the hospital had the capital to do so. But remember, it can only choose one investment to pursue because of its limited budget. So which one do we choose? The MRI machine, because it has the highest NPV, even higher than the dialysis machine, despite the earlier payback of the latter. Okay, now that we have worked through a simple but practical example, let me mention some general rules and concepts that are important when we calculate the net present value of any investment opportunity. The first is that sensitivity analysis is important. Any quantitative model's output is only as good as the inputs. As I like to tell students when they are putting together quantitative models, there is an important acronym never to forget. GIGO. Garbage in, garbage out. Obviously, any investment model requires predictions about the unknown and uncertain future. So it is important that we put together what-if scenarios, perhaps best, worst, and base case scenarios for any investment we are considering. So in our example before, definitive inputs for each of the three potential investments, but we know that the actual results may differ from what we anticipate. So we might consider different inputs for each investment and rerun the model, just to be sure we are making the best decision possible. The second concept you need to keep in mind is that cash flows are normally the relevant thing to discount for most organizations, and not just any cash flows, but after-tax cash flows, not accounting profits or some other measure. Granted, this may require us to make some assumptions about the tax rates we'll have to pay, both today and in future years, but we should at least consider them. Obviously, failing to consider taxes can lead to faulty investment analysis and conclusions. Obviously, if the organization is a charitable organization or other not-for-profit, then there would likely be no tax considerations to make. The third is that these concepts can, in fact, apply to philanthropic organizations as well, those entities who are not so concerned about cash flows generated by their investments, but about the achievement of some other outcomes, maybe the prevention of certain diseases in the future, improving children's test scores, or helping the homeless. For these organizations, the concepts embedded in net present value are just as relevant. For example, the Gates Foundation, which is trying to minimize the future incidence of HIV infection in Africa, only spends money on disease prevention as opposed to treatment of those already infected. While this has not been without controversy, the foundation is trying to achieve the maximum return on its philanthropic dollars. To the extent that they prevent the infection in just one person, that will reduce the future spread of the disease to others, which would not be the case if the money were spent on treating an infected individual. It is analogous to the old adage that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. In words, these charities are trying to minimize the present value of future diseases or outbreaks. The final general rule is that when applying the net present value formula, we should consider only incremental cash flows in the numerator of our formula. For example, let's assume that a company with several operations in the Southeast is considering opening a new facility in sunny Southern California, but will continue operating its other business units. Which cash flows should be considered in evaluating the new business proposition? Only the incremental cash flows, the amount that needs to be invested in the new operations, and the additional net cash inflows that are expected to be earned from the new location. Here is another example. Imagine a pharmaceutical company that has been performing research on a potentially new blockbuster drug, and the company has already spent hundreds of millions of dollars over a period of several years. The question becomes whether the research should continue to be funded in the coming year or not. This is just the sort of decision that pharmaceutical companies routinely have to make. The critical point is that previously expended money is irrelevant to the investment decision. Since the previously expended research dollars are sunk, they are already spent. All that matters looking forward are the incremental cash flows, the amount of money projected to be needed to finish the research, and the expected cash inflows from future revenues, assuming the research is successful and leads to a new drug. In a simple analogy, if the Los Angeles Lakers were for sale, one shouldn't buy them just because of the championships they've won in the past. I'm not trying to spread any rumors, but just want to make the point. The final concept I would mention about net present value is that we must treat inflation consistently. That is, our projected cash flows should be nominal and not discounted for inflation. After all, that is the whole point of discounting, to put future nominal cash flows into today's dollars. If you put the future cash flows into today's dollars and then discount them for inflation, that would essentially be double counting. With these general rules in mind, let's review the steps for applying the NPV formula. Basically, there are six. First, estimate the total upfront costs of the investment, usually consisting of the purchase price, commissions, taxes, and the like. Two, estimate the future cash flows expected to be derived from the investment over whatever the relevant time period is expected to be. If the investment has a finite life, like a piece of machinery or equipment, we estimate the cash flows over that particular period of time. If the investment is considered to be a perpetuity, something with an indefinite life, like an investment in a new business, a piece of real estate, or a stock, we should estimate what we think it will be worth at some future point in time, say in 5 or 10 years. Trying to predict cash flows and valuations beyond 10 years is nearly impossible, so that is about as far out as I encourage my students to go. Besides, if any of you out there can predict the future, please contact me as soon as possible since we have a partnership to put together. The third step is to assess the riskiness of the cash flows. Is this a really high-risk investment or something less risky? With this risk assessment in mind, we must determine the appropriate discount rate to use in our net present value formula. In a future lecture, we will discuss in detail how to think about the right discount rate to use when modeling our future cash flows. Once we have the projected cash flows, the relevant time period for our model, and a base discount rate to apply, we can compute the net present value. If the net present value is negative, that would generally mean it is an investment we should avoid making. The fifth step is to sensitize the key inputs, the projected cash flows and the discount rate, to provide certain what-if scenarios. These scenarios would typically be a base case, a best case, and a worst case. That is what I require of my students, three different scenarios. And finally, make the investment decision, knowing you have done the best analytical job you can with the data at your disposal. I have always said that I would love to see the spreadsheet model and net present value calculations that I think must have been made to justify AOL's acquisition of Time Warner for $164 billion. They must have included some truly out-of-this-world assumptions involving ever-increasing cash flows and or a very low discount rate, or both. But given just how much was paid and lost, it is just as likely that investors and Wall Street analysts were focused on financial accounting metrics or things like synergies and new distribution channels for content, and they lost sight of what really matters and what really generates value, cash flows. Incremental cash flows discounted to present value in a net present value formula. Well, this concludes our lecture on net present value, an extraordinarily important tool to have in our finance toolbox. Until next time, when we will discuss alternatives to the net present value approach, I look forward to chatting with you then.
This lecture is titled Alternatives to Net Present Value.
Imagine that a close friend approaches you at a barbecue and tells you that she has a lucrative real estate investment opportunity that she would like you to participate in, the acquisition of a small rental property that needs some updating and renovations. She tells you that after the renovations are done, the property could be sold for a nice profit. The investment requires $100,000, and she asks you to go in 50-50 with her. The opportunity sounds enticing, and you have been looking for some investments outside of your stock and bond portfolio. Having taken this course, you know that net present value, or NPV, is a very robust and meaningful way to analyze investment opportunities. You also remember that the net present value formula requires three variables: the initial investment amount, projections of expected cash flows from the investment over time, and finally, the discount rate, the interest rate used to put future cash flows into their present value equivalents. So you ask your friend, who has a fairly strong background in finance, whether she has calculated the net present value for the opportunity. After a short pause while she digests the exceptional question you have just asked, your friend tells you that she hasn't calculated the NPV. Yes, she knows how much the initial investment will require, how much she expects to spend on renovations, and how much the property might be worth upon completion of the renovations, but she just wasn't sure what discount rate to use. Also, knowing how complicated it can be to determine the right discount rate, you nod in sympathy, but are still uncomfortable committing to the investment in the absence of more formal mathematical analysis of the opportunity. However, your friend then interrupts you while you are in deep thought and tells you that although she has not computed the net present value for the investment, she can tell you that it has an internal rate of return of 12%, which she finds quite attractive. Then your friend reiterates that she'd really like you to join in on the investment, but you'll need to make a decision fairly quickly since escrow is closing shortly and time is of the essence. The clock is ticking. In this lecture, we are going to discuss what the friend meant when she said that the investment had a 12% internal rate of return, or IRR for short. We will also present some other alternatives to analyzing and evaluating investment opportunities beyond net present value, including the profitability index and equity multiples. However, before we get too far into the discussion, let's first quickly reintroduce the key elements of net present value. You will recall that the net present value is the sum of the present values of any cash outflows required for a particular investment, plus the present value of any future cash inflows. These cash inflows might be dividends, interest, rents, or other income, depending on the investment, whether it's stocks, bonds, real estate, or something else. Again, all of the anticipated cash flows over time, both in and out, are restated in today's equivalent dollars using a discount rate, which is an interest rate based in part on the riskiness of the particular investment. As we discussed, the critical rule is that if the net present value is greater than zero, meaning that the present value of anticipated cash inflows exceeds the present value of your initial cash outflow, it is an investment that you should make, as it will create value for the investor. However, if the net present value is negative, you should avoid the investment and run, Forrest, run, as the investment is expected to destroy value. However, as terrific a tool as net present value is for evaluating investment opportunities, it does have its practical limitations and challenges when we apply it in the real world. One of the difficulties is how to determine the proper discount rate we should use when computing the present values for the cash flows an investment is expected to generate over time. To this point, all we have said is the discount rate should reflect an investment's risk, as well as what the risk-free rate is at the time we make the investment. While we will discuss discount rates in greater detail in our next lecture, the reality is that determining the proper discount rate is very challenging in the real world, especially for individual investors. Corporations and large institutional investors are better able to determine an appropriate discount rate both for any particular investment and for their investment portfolio as a whole. The other challenge in using net present value as an investment tool is that it is hard to interpret what it means beyond telling us whether an investment should or should not be made. But investors usually want to know more, like what the rate of return will be on an investment. For example, if I tell you that a particular investment opportunity has a net present value of $1,400 at a discount rate of 8%, how do you interpret that? Well, you know that it is positive, obviously a good thing, and that the investment is expected to earn more than 8% by definition. However, a logical follow-up question is, can you tell me what rate of return I am estimated to earn on this investment? In other words, while I know that the investment is going to yield more than 8% because it has a positive net present value at 8%, an investor might want to know whether the opportunity will earn 8.02% or 10.5% or something else. Net present value does not help communicate this important data point. As a result of these practical shortcomings, a very common and widely used return measure is something known as the internal rate of return, or IRR for short. In some industries, it is one of the principal metrics that is used to evaluate the attractiveness of an investment opportunity. These include venture capital funds and private equity funds that invest in real estate or individual companies. So what is the internal rate of return? Mathematically, the internal rate of return is the discount rate at which the net present value is equal to zero. Sort of a break-even discount rate. Again, IRR is the discount rate at which the net present value equals zero. So to get the internal rate of return, you pull the NPV formula from your finance toolkit. Remember, we learned that formula in our last lecture. Then you set the NPV value equal to zero and solve for the missing variable I. Another helpful way to look at this is to imagine a graph of what happens to the net present value of any investment as the discount rate goes up. As the discount rate goes up, the value of all future cash flows go down. Therefore, the NPV goes down. This is an important intuition you should have. At some point, as the discount rate continues to increase, the net present value crosses the x-axis. That point is the internal rate of return. Let's work through a simple example to highlight how the IRR is calculated, first and foremost, and then try to explain the intuition behind the calculation and why it is so popular and so often used in the real world. Let's revisit the example we started this lecture with. You're offered a potential investment opportunity in a piece of income-producing real estate, perhaps a duplex that needs to be renovated and then resold, presumably for a nice profit. Assume that the initial down payment required is $100,000, which includes the budget for renovations and repairs, and that you will borrow $200,000 from a bank to complete the purchase. You estimate that the investment will generate some net income before taxes of $8,000 in each of the next 3 years, including interest payments to the bank. And at the end of the 3 years, you think the investment will be worth $320,000, at which point you pay back the bank the $200,000 you borrowed, leaving $120,000 left over to distribute to the partners. Again, you buy a property for $300,000, including a budget for repairs, borrow $200,000, investing the $100,000 difference. You own and operate the property for 3 years, generating some modest cash flows of $8,000 each year, and then expect to sell the property for $320,000. Let's answer two questions. One, what would be the net present value of the investment at a discount rate of 8%? And two, what is the internal rate of return of the investment? To compute the net present value, we know that the initial investment is an outflow of $100,000, and that we have to discount all the other cash flows to their present values. Let's assume a discount rate of 8%. At that rate, the $8,000 of cash inflow in the first year, for example, is worth $7,407. The math is just $8,000 divided by 1.08. The $8,000 of cash flow in year two is worth approximately $6,859, or $8,000 divided by 1.08 squared, and so forth. Remember that in the third year, we're adding the $120,000 profit from the sale of the house to the $8,000 annual net income for that year. Now, when we do the math, we find that the NPV, the net present value on this real estate investment, is $16,582. The result is clearly positive, which is the goal. So we anticipate that this will be a good investment, one that we expect will earn more than 8%. But what if we are unsure about what discount rate to use and want to know what the actual rate of return on the investment will be? That's where calculating an internal rate of return comes in. Again, to calculate the internal rate of return, we're really solving for a particular discount rate in the NPV equation. And to do that, we set the NPV equal to zero. So in this case, we'll set zero equal to minus $100,000, which is our initial down payment, plus $8,000 in year one discounted at some unknown to be solved I. In year two, 8,000 divided by one plus this unknown I squared. And then in year three, we sell the house, generating $120,000 profit, have the $8,000 of income from that year, again, discounted for an unknown I to the third power. Unfortunately, for investment opportunities lasting more than two periods, it is not possible to solve algebraically for the internal rate of return from our discounted cash flow equation. As a result, there are three ways to calculate the internal rate of return. One is good old trial and error. You can simply keep trying different discount rates until one gives you an NPV equal to zero. Here, since you know that the net present value is positive at 8%, you can try 9%, then 10%, and so forth. And so long as the NPV is positive, you keep going. Once the NPV is negative, you stop and try a lower figure. Within a few minutes, you usually can get an approximation of the IRR. The second approach is to graph the function. Calculate the first few guesses of a trial and error approach. Graph these and then extrapolate to where the graph crosses the x-axis, and you have your internal rate of return. Or three, use a financial calculator or computer spreadsheet like Microsoft Excel. For those of you with smartphones, there are free financial calculator apps available, as well as those available for purchase. Those can be very handy, and I use mine almost daily. Well, in this case, if you solve for the unknown discount rate, you get about 14.1%. That is, if you take all the future cash flows, the $8,000 earned in each of the first 2 years and the $128,000 earned in year three, and solve for the discount rate at which the NPV is zero, you get 14.1%. Now stop and think for a moment. Suppose I tell you that I have an investment that has a net present value of $16,582 using a discount rate of 8%. Now alternatively, suppose I tell you that I have an investment opportunity that has an internal rate of return of 14.1%. Which of these propositions is more meaningful to you? Which do you understand more intuitively? Most people have a better intuition regarding the latter. It's just because they have an easier frame of reference. Most of us understand what interest rates various investments are paying, perhaps savings accounts or certificates of deposit at our banks, or the rates that various bonds are paying, or maybe the dividend yields on our favorite stocks. Speaking in terms of interest rates perhaps gives us an easier frame of reference and explains just why the internal rate of return is so widely used out in the real world. And yet, despite its intuitive attractiveness, the internal rate of return does suffer from some significant deficiencies. More about that in a few minutes. Meanwhile, the internal rate of return rule, as it is applied, is fairly straightforward. Essentially, if the internal rate of return you compute or estimate from an investment opportunity is greater than the rate of return you require on an investment, you proceed with the opportunity. If the internal rate of return is less than the required rate of return, you reject it and continue looking. This is another finance definition for our toolboxes. For example, if you determine that a project has an internal rate of return of 13%, meaning that the net present value equals zero at a 13% discount rate, you make the investment so long as you require less than a 13% return for that particular opportunity. However, while internal rate of return is widely used and cited, it has some significant drawbacks and limitations, and we should be aware of them. One of them is what we call the size problem. For example, what if I tell you that I have an investment opportunity with 100% internal rate of return? I imagine that might just pique your interest. Where do I sign up for that one? But what if I tell you in the very next breath that the investment only requires 10 bucks? So you give me $10 and I give you back 20 in a few days. Granted, that isn't too shabby a deal, but not too many investors are going to get overly excited about it. Would you rather invest 10 bucks and get back 20 or 10,000 to get back 13,000? The latter has a lower internal rate of return, a mere 30% compared to the 100% in the first opportunity. But I think most of us would get far more excited about the latter investment than the former, despite the lower IRR. With net present value, you don't have this same problem, as it takes into account the actual amounts of the cash inflows and outflows. The other shortcomings with the internal rate of return are a bit more complicated, but very important to understand. If I asked you whether you would rather earn 10% on an investment that will last just 1 year, or 8% each year on an investment that will last for 4 years, which would you prefer? That is a real conundrum, to be sure, as longer-term cash flows may have lower internal rates of return, all else equal. But many of us would prefer to make longer-term investments and not have to deal with what is known as reinvestment risk. That's the risk we face when we sell an investment or we receive our money back at the end of a particular investment, and we need to reinvest the proceeds. For me, I would rather earn 8% for a longer period of time than 10% for just 1 year, especially when interest rates are low. Because the internal rate of return is just expressed as a percentage, it says nothing about the duration of the investment, how long it is expected to last. Another significant shortcoming with internal rates of return has to do with good old mathematics. Some investments, especially in a corporate context, have negative cash flows for a long period of time. Some examples might include research and development projects, for example, or extensive construction if it's a real estate investment. In other cases, you may have an investment which at times throws off cash flows and at other times requires that cash be invested. Perhaps you own a service company which you are paid up front for something but then spend money afterwards. The problem with these situations is that you may get multiple answers to the internal rate of return equation. In a certain sense, the problem is that when you are receiving cash flows from an investment, you get to reinvest them, of course. And the internal rate of return approach assumes you can reinvest these cash flows in other projects that can earn the same rates of return as the current project, which may or may not be true. However, when you have to spend money on an investment you already have, say putting a new roof on a property you own, you are essentially lending money to the project. While the net present value formula can handle projects that both throw off and require cash, the internal rate of return formula cannot. This makes IRR a popular and common method choice for analyzing venture capital and private equity investments, as these investment strategies usually require cash investments throughout their lives, but only one cash inflow at the end of the project, perhaps an initial public offering, or a sale of the asset to another investor or firm. Finally, how do we compare two mutually exclusive investment opportunities? That is, imagine we are presented with two possible investments, and yet we can only invest in one. Consider for a moment two potential investment projects. The first requires an investment of $10,000 and is expected to return $12,000 in a year. The second requires an investment of $1,000 and you double your money in a year to $2,000. The first, therefore, has an internal rate of return of 20%, and the second, an internal rate of return of 100%. Yowza! Finally, let's assume that the appropriate discount rate for both projects is 10%. Now, if you use this information to calculate the net present value for each project, what do you find? Should you jump at the second opportunity? The answer is actually no, as the first has a higher NPV equal to $909 versus the second, which has a net present value equal to $818. The internal rate of return leads to the wrong decision here because it does not take into account the different scales or sizes of the projects. The bigger project has a smaller percentage return, but a larger dollar return. The NPV formula picks this difference up, but the internal rate of return does not. Therefore, the net present value approach is the more robust and appropriate return measure, all else equal, even though the internal rate of return is so widely used out in the real world. At this point, I want to paint a different scenario, one that is quite common in corporate environments. Imagine you are the chief financial officer, and based on this year's budget, you have a certain fixed amount you can spend on capital projects in the coming fiscal year. Meanwhile, various managers have provided you with a slew of different potential investment opportunities, all of which appear to have the same strategic importance and all of which have positive net present values. Which project or projects do you choose among the competing alternatives? The profitability index is helpful in these contexts. The profitability index is defined as the net present value of an opportunity divided by the amount of the initial investment. Again, you take the net present value of the investment divided by the amount of initial investment required. You can sort of think of it as being the bang for the buck. Basically, as a chief financial officer weighing investment options, you can calculate the profitability index and use it to rank all of the various investment alternatives that are being considered. Then, working from the highest ranked opportunity, the one with the highest profitability index, to the lowest, you can invest in one project after another until all the available funds are expended. Let's work through an example. Imagine a certain organization has a budget for capital projects of $2 million this year, and the chief financial officer has five different potential projects to invest in sitting atop his or her desk. All have positive NPVs, ranging from $25,000 to $125,000, all at discount rates of 10%. So if the company had an unlimited investment budget, they should do all five. But such is not the case. The tricky part is that while all have positive NPVs, each requires a different investment amount. For example, investment B, with a net present value of $125,000, requires $1.1 million, while project D has a net present value of $25,000 and requires $500,000. Therefore, we compute the profitability indices for all five. For example, take investment B, which requires $1.1 million and has a net present value of $125,000. Its profitability index is 0.114, or 125,000 divided by 1.1 million. If we rank each project by the profitability index, which are the most attractive? First comes Project E, as it has a profitability index of 0.15. Then C, with a profitability index of 0.13. Then B, then A, and last, and in this case least, Project D. So we choose E to start, which requires an investment of $400,000,